Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I have a very supportive wife and two children, and they don't really care about what work hardship I might have just endured. It can be frustrating, and certainly the last few years have been very frustrating because of all the lying. Beyond that, I go home and my kids are completely in kidland, and my wife is in their world and also what she does, and so the perspective is always there. The perspective of, that's great that you're on TV, but we have a Spanish test to study for. That's important. And that's really helpful because it's much more important in the minds of the people who I love so much.
Welcome to the latest episode of Just Getting Started. My good friend Jake Tapper, who's got a new book out called The Devil May Dance, is today's guest. How are you, Jake Tapper?
I'm good, my friend. People should know that that's not just showbiz BS.
No.
You and I have a genuine love and affection for one another. I see you and I'm like...
That is true.
I really am crazy about you. I really think you're a wonderful guy. I really do. It's true. And we go way back.
We do.
To the 90s.
This podcast is about origin stories, and I guess we should start with ours in a way. Was it the late 90s when a mutual friend, my fellow SportsCenter anchor at the time, Brett Haber, got us all together one night in Washington, D.C.? Is that when that was?
It feels like it was.
I think so.
I feel like I wrote for Washington City Paper at the time. Is that possible?
When were you with Salon.com?
99 to
2002-ish. That's it.
But I mean, like, you were so far. I don't even know what event we were at. Brett's a...
Yeah, I don't remember either.
A college classmate of mine, and I was friends with him and his lovely now ex-wife, Jennifer, a great woman. And you were so funny that night. They had these like fried potato things at this event.
Right.
And you kept calling them latkes, like mispronunciation of latkes. I think you had a girlfriend at the time, or you didn't have a wife, did you?
Not in the late 90s, no. Not in the late 90s.
You were helping me meet a girl named Tammy that I ended up dating briefly, but you were assisting. You were like the best wingman a guy could have. You literally were trying to make her laugh and get her to talk to me. Do you remember that?
I do remember that, you know, and it was a heck of a night, and I had no idea that it actually worked out even in the slightest way for you. Jake.
For me, it did. For poor Tammy, we can't say that's true. She got the fuzzy end of the lollipop on that one. But for me, it did. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So that's our origin story. And then we kind of kept in brief touch. And then I think we reacquainted ourselves through a charity event we do every year, the Big Slick.
Yeah. In Kansas City. Yes. That is when we did kind of reconnect in person. In Kansas City.
Yeah, we emailed. We emailed, but it was the first time. Yeah,
absolutely. And I guess before we get into your actual professional origin story, I think I need to point out for, or have you at least point out for those who watch this podcast on my YouTube stream, on the Rich Eisen Show YouTube stream, what in the hell is happening to your office behind you? For such a successful man... I mean, there's like a coat rack, a small little, that looks like that you put together yourself, a little rack.
It's not good.
A mini fridge.
There's nothing good happening.
Are those supplements next to an empty coffee can behind you right there?
It's protein. It's protein for a protein shake.
Okay.
I do have protein shakes. That's the, our mutual friend, Paul Rudd, when I was trying to lose weight, he put me on the diet that he went on. To get an Ant-Man shape. And part of that is two protein shakes late morning and late afternoon.
You're in the like there's a TB12 system in the National Football League. You're on the PR Ant-Man, the Paul Rudd Ant-Man system.
Well, yeah, I mean, like if he's I'm more like a kind of like a cockroach maybe. Like if he's the Ant-Man, I'm not as devoted or dedicated
right
to it. Like I'm really good on the Paul Rudd diet until, you know, like 7 p.m.
Right.
Which is not, that's not really how diets work.
No.
Anyway. but no, they're doing construction.
Yes.
On my entire floor, of CNN. So I came in after they let us come back into the offices and all my stuff's in box. These aren't even, but you see these boxes right here. These aren't even boxes of my stuff. This is somebody else's stuff.
Are those just ties? Are those ties?
Yeah, the ties and shirts are mine. I got jackets over here. But normally there's a little bit more rhyme and reason, and the tie rack is, you know, it's everything's in storage. I don't know what's going on, and I don't know when I'm getting anything back. I have no control over everything. But I do have ties and shirts.
And you've got this book. How about that for a segue? There we go. I got the Devil May Dance right here for everybody. You have a copy too. You know, and I want to get to that in a minute, but I want your origin story first. How did you start? How did you get started, Jake Tapper? How does somebody get to be on the career path that you are still following?
You know, it's so funny. We're going to talk about my origin story as a journalist, not as an author, because I'm a journalist.
No, I mean, we'll get to that because you're clearly what you're doing, I guess your day job, your night job or whatever, that is, it's something that you love to do, but you're also trying else something new as well, which I'd want to delve into that. But before we get to all of that as an author, yes.
Okay.
How did you start?
The truth of the matter is that it's kind of odd that I didn't think about going into journalism until my mid-20s because it was part of my life from the very beginning. I am actually named after my dad's great uncle, who was a managing editor at the Chicago Sun-Times. And I did like a newspaper for our neighborhood when I was a kid, and I was editor of the school paper in high school and all this stuff. But then I just had no interest in it, I guess. When I went to college, I wanted to be a cartoonist. Long story short, I end up in my mid-20s having no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And I was on a ski trip with some friends. And one of the friends was holding a copy of the New Republic magazine, which in the 90s was just like, it was the hottest, coolest, and most interesting. Like Michael Lewis wrote for them. It was just a great magazine. And there was a story in there by a couple guys that my friends knew. And it was like a light bulb going off, like, oh, my God, like actual people that we know just like come up with ideas and write freelance stories in magazines. And it was just like a revelation to me. And I started doing freelance writing for anyone that would publish me, anyone. The Dartmouth Alumni Magazine, I pitched something to Entertainment Weekly, and just like I didn't know enough to not be as bold as I was and just pitching and pitching and pitching. Anyway, a few years later, I had a ton of clips and Washington City Paper hired me. And from there, it was just a matter of Washington City Paper to Salon. When I was at Salon, I started doing some TV stuff here and there for CNN and others. And then I really kind of got the bug, the TV thing. I was doing freelance writing, but I went to start learning about TV. Eventually, I put together a reel. And then I went to ABC News. That was a whole sink or swim environment, but I was there for 9 years and then worked my way up to CNN offering me my own show to anchor. And I came here in 2013.
What do you mean by sink or swim, Jake? What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, just ABC News was tough. It was a very competitive environment. There were very few minutes in the day. You were just constantly competing with other journalists to get on air. It wasn't like, here's 10 reporters and like, there wasn't some benevolent leader saying, and we're going to make sure everybody gets on air 3 times a week. It was like a newsroom. Imagine a newsroom of a newspaper, but it's only one page a day. Right. And it was that kind of thing. And like, you're just constantly competing. I wasn't the prettiest and I wasn't the sharpest broadcaster. And I wasn't, the only thing I could do is pitch the best ideas and break the most stories. And that's it. I mean, it was just based on work ethic. Because it couldn't be based on, I mean, there were people that were much smoother on television. There were people that were like, you know, underwear model, good looking. And then there was me. And all I could do was work the hardest, pitch the most creative ideas, break stories. And so that's what I did. And it worked.
Was Peter Jennings still there? I mean, was that?
Peter Jennings was there. Yep.
What was he like?
When I started at ABC News.
Yeah.
It was just, I mean, it was. Diane Sawyer and Charlie Gibson in the morning.
Right.
Robin Roberts did the news. Peter Jennings in the evening and Ted Koppel doing Nightline at night at 11:30. And, you know, it was a dream and I was with giants of the industry and, you know, they're all retired or in Peter's case, passed away. I think as Diane's in semi-retirement, she still does pieces for ABC News every now and then. It still does specials. But, I mean, it was just a very competitive place.
Yeah, I know. I remember when I first got to ESPN, Robin Roberts was there too. She was on the early evening sports center and I was just so taken aback that I was thrown in the midst of all of these people who I watched on television.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out my own way at that point in time was pretty damn daunting. I mean, I didn't have to work to get on the, I mean, I was scheduled to do SportsCenter. I didn't have to, like what you're talking about, kind of have to sing for your supper to get on the air because there were so many people just trying to get on one show in a way, you know, and I'm wondering if how pressurized that must have been for you at the time.
Well, I mean, think about it. I mean, first of all, we should say, I guess your viewers and listeners know your origin story, but I mean, like you were there at a time. It was Keith Olbermann, Craig Kilborn. I mean, just Dan Patrick, giants.
Right. Well, it's similar to what you're talking about arriving at ABC News. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, that was in that regard.
But those were not the people I was listening were not my peers. They were, you know, they were the anchors. I was just a correspondent. But it was real sink or swim. And you know, when you're starting your career, you're an anchor now. I'm an anchor now. We're not worried about getting on air. We have our shows. We're worried about making them as good as possible, but we're not worried about getting on air. But when you are a correspondent, getting on air is like oxygen. And when you're not on air, you're like a fish thrown on the boat. And like, you're just like, I guess it's the opposite now. I switched to an oxygen metaphor now.
No, it's okay. I like it.
The opposite metaphor now. But my point is like you're flailing because you're not getting on air. What is your worth? And yeah, and it was very, very competitive. And look, also, like, some very, very tough executive producers and anchors and senior producers and others. I mean, some that were just absolutely lovely and took a chance with me. The very first person to take a chance with me at ABC News, other than the people who hired me, were Diane Sawyer and Shelley Ross, who was the then legendary producer, executive producer of Good Morning America. And they put me on air. And again, it was just work ethic. I can tell you exactly what happened. My big break at ABC News, because you get hired by ABC News, that doesn't mean you're going to succeed at ABC News. And I saw lots of really good, talented, smart people get hired by ABC News and just thrown in the shark tank and like you just never saw them again. And then 3 years later, the contract was over and you hear that they were going to someplace else. But what happened was I was on email and Schwarzenegger was going on Leno. He announced that this is 2003. He announced that he was going to run against Gray Davis, the governor of California. He was going to run against him in the recall election. Y'all are having one of those out there. Some of the same candidates, Mary Carey, God bless her. Anyway, I know that's your favorite. I know you've maxed out.
Yes.
If you know what I mean.
Hey now, Cinemaxed out. Yes. I understand what you're saying.
Yes. That's what I call it. Anyway, sorry. I'll keep it clean. For the kids. So anyway, Schwarzenegger was right. So the transcript comes out at like, I don't even know, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock before it airs at 11:30. This is a different era people don't even, the kids listening. The internet existed, but there were no smartphones, no Facebook, no Twitter. So it was basically just email and websites was how you got information. So I immediately pitched myself to Shelley and Diane and their team. I knew enough. I've been pitching stories for months, having less and less success, but pitching them. Anyway, I was just like, oh, here's an idea. Schwarzenegger's running. Let me do a piece about this, and I will incorporate classic Schwarzenegger film lines in this piece. I don't know if this exists somewhere.
Yes.
But I don't even think the pitch was it. I think it was just the fact that anybody was pitching this to them, that anybody was like, this just happened. I want to be on air. I want to tell the story. Let me tell the story. I'm here. I'll work through the night. You know, I'm ready. And I always tell young people, like, you have to have something that they want. Nobody's going to give you a job to be nice. You have to have something that they want. And it might just be that you're willing to get up at 2 a.m. and do whatever the hell, you know what I mean? It might just be work ethic.
Sure.
That's what I offered. I started doing story after story after story. And the next thing I knew, I was living at the Standard in LA and covering the recall for Good Morning America.
And now here you are, obviously, all these years later. So just before we move on, and then we'll get to your book. So obviously the Schwarzenegger Total Recall, that was an easy one. What else did you work in? What else?
I don't know. It was none of my favorites. It was none of the, you know, Audi Hauser, if you're watching this, you have a tower wrapped around your head and Cohagen on your ass. I don't know how to work that one in.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's not a tumor.
It's right. It's not a tumor. Okay, so you got a kindergarten cop twin. Twins might be something you could work in. I'm just trying to see. Obviously, you know, Schwarzenegger with winning a recall. I'll be back with part of it.
I don't know. I'm not saying this was not an audition for the Algonquin Round Table. Okay? I'm not saying that these are bon mots that I want on my mausoleum someday. All right? I was just saying. This wasn't Isaac Newton. Yes. My point was not that this was a brilliant idea. It was just like, I was just like, what do you want me to do? I'm here. I'll do it. You know what I mean?
Oh, man.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
All right, so let's get to some here and now, this book that you have written.
Yeah.
Okay, The Devil May Dance. This is your second novel.
And my second novel, but the first one I wrote that I thought, you know, I think Rich would really like this novel.
Well, I mean, you know, I read your first novel as well.
I know, but and you were very nice and complimentary and supportive.
Of course.
But you are a Sinatra fan.
Yes. So
you
this
are
is
a Frank Sinatra fan.
This is directly.
This
I should
is
hold
all
up,
about Sinatra.
I should hold up the front. This is going to be my reading when I actually have time in June, because that's what I will, you know, I guess that's life. Riding High in April, shot down in May. But, you know, nice. I'm sort of, you know, that's what I'm saying. I know I'm going to change that tune when I'm back in June, which is when I'm going to read this. Thank you very much.
It.
That is my karaoke go-to right there. So,
but you are honestly, of everyone I know.
Yes.
And I, you know, I'm not, you know this.
You know a lot of people. You know a lot of people. I mean, Paul Rudd gave you supplements for crying out loud. You know,
no,
I mean.
But he did actually recommend that brand. But of all the people I know, and you know that I am just as insecure as the next person. You know that's
You're
true.
You're being
you
very know self-effacing. True. No,
you know that's true. Okay. I'm very, but you are the only person about whom I would say, I know you're going to love this book. I am so confident you're going to love this book because you love Sinatra. You love the Kennedys. You love that era. And also just because you're a supportive friend, you're coming to the table expecting, like, with all of your heart, all of your nachas is going to pour into the reading of this book, all of your nachas.
And I love the Manchurian Candidate, and I can't believe that that is a crucial part of the points of this novel. So I mean, like you're nailing all of the touch points for me.
It's all your sweet spots.
It is all.
If your wife was a character in the book, then that would be, and your kids. That would
be the end of it. But
it wouldn't make any sense because it takes place in 1962.
I know that. I know. I can't wait to read it. So I guess my question for you is why do you do this? Why do you want to write a novel? Why do you want to do this now twice? Why?
Not only do I want to write a novel, I want you to write a book, and I've pitched you your own book. I've told you this is what you wrote. So anyway.
I know you have. No, I know. And that's why you're such
a
great
bestseller.
Friend. I know.
Everybody's going to read it.
I know. I'm too busy doing stuff like this. That's why I can't understand how you have time, how you cover like the election of our lifetimes. You are all over.
Yeah, but then it's over.
I don't know how you do that. Like I'm covering an NFL season and then doing this podcast and then, you know, I have three kids. I mean, you're a dad of two.
That's what it is. I only have two.
Is that right?
I only have two kids.
This is your third baby right here. Right? There's your third baby.
The only thing I can say is, first of all, people like you and I, and probably a lot of your listeners and viewers, you know, we're a little type A. We're very driven. We're very, very driven people. And I really like writing. And now I'm doing journalism and I love journalism, but I also love writing and it brings me joy. And it also is a welcome escape for me from the nonstop nastiness, death, and destruction that I've been covering for the last period of time. So it's enjoyable for me. This was fun because what inspired the book was a story that you're probably familiar with, which is in 1960, Sinatra and the Rat Pack worked their hearts out for President Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, to get elected president. And Sinatra, who is a friend of the president, then expects that John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy, will stay with him when he comes and visits out by your way at some point during his presidency. Sinatra, he has an estate in Rancho Mirage at this point. It's not the later estate he has in Palm Springs. This is Rancho Mirage. He calls it the compound, and he starts to build it up. This is a real story. This is not my fiction. Builds rooms, installs telephone lines, has a helipad built so that President Kennedy can stay with him. And at the same time, Attorney General Robert Kennedy is investigating organized crime, and it becomes pretty apparent to him that Sinatra is friends with a lot of the people he's investigating, namely Sam Giancana, but also handsome Johnny Roselli from Los Angeles and others. So this becomes a decision that Robert Kennedy has to make. Do I piss off Frank Sinatra, one of the biggest stars in the world who helped my brother get elected, or do I let my brother stay at a place where mobsters frequent? And that's the premise and inspiration for the book. I have in my book, Attorney General Kennedy basically blackmails Charlie and Margaret, the heroes of my first book, to go out and investigate to see if Sinatra's really mobbed up. And the premise is that Charlie is a World War II hero and a politician. He's a congressman. So he'll be a consultant on the Manchurian Candidate, which they're filming right at that point.
So
sold, right?
No, course. I'm look, again, the Hellfire Club was so phenomenal. And this, I honestly, I'm not just saying it because you're a friend and a guest and all of that stuff. And I do love you. I cannot wait to, you know, crack this book. And I hope to have like a week's time to just do nothing but just curl up with Jake Tapper in writing style. And you'll finish it in
a weekend. But beyond that, let me also say I would like to curl up with you.
Thank you.
But that's a separate issue. Spooning.
So do you? That's what I'm saying. It's like
I can be the front spooner, the back spooner.
I am totally in awe, Jake, because I know what you must go through to do your show every day, and then go home and put it aside to just be a dad and a husband. And then put that aside to be a novelist. I cannot fathom the brain equity it requires and discipline it must require. Did you ever have a point where, like, I am not writing today. I just don't have it in me. Like, I can't, I'm going to put it down. I'm going to stop, because that could be obviously a death blow, because you have to keep going to keep writing a book
not
like this.
Not because of energy. There were times that I wrote myself into a corner in terms of the plot that I thought, oh fuck, I don't know how I'm going to get out of this. And I took a few days to, like, you know, marinate.
But there wasn't, like, you know, an attack on the Capitol that took you. I guess you were finished writing at that point in time, right?
Yeah.
So when did you finish this? During the election? During the actual election? When did you finish it? When did you send in your last pages and it was locked?
I think last summer, at the end of last summer. No, Labor Day. Okay. By Labor Day, it was done. But also, let me just add, like, yes, I had the presidential election to cover, and my day job is busy and all that. But last year, from April to August, I was broadcasting from home. So that's an hour and a half commute that you don't have. Also, you know this, when you're in the office, how much of your time is wasted because people are popping in your office, talking to you?
Right.
It's not wasted. It's, you know, it's lovely.
No, I understand what you're saying. Yes.
But time that's you could spend doing other things. Also, in a normal election year, I'd be traveling all over the place. Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, battleground state, debate. Last year, after the pandemic hit, I did two trips the whole year for work. Two. One time we flew to Michigan to interview Biden. And another time, after he won, I drove to Wilmington to interview him and Vice President Harris. But so the truth is, in 2020, I had a lot more openings in my calendar than I normally would.
Interesting. Oh, man. And now you're back in the office and they stick you in a closet. I don't know what's going on with them, man. I don't understand. I would
I feel like Groundskeeper Willie is going to show up with a giant mop.
Do you have already a third novel idea picked out, or you just got to tap out?
I have a setting. I have a third novel setting. So the first book is in the 50s. This book, The Devil May Dance, is in the 60s. So I think I'm going to do the 70s. And my publisher is eager for me to maybe I think I'm going to do Charlie and Margaret's son. They have two kids, Lucy and Dwight. I think Dwight, who will be 18, 19 in the mid 70s, might be a fun main character to have, because Charlie and Margaret are Charlie's troubled, but they're good people, but maybe I could do something of a kind of like a badass, kind of like an anti-hero. I don't know. That might be fun.
So
the
you're
disco era.
You're or a disco. That's what I was asking. What 70s, mid 70s, like a
disco,
Bee Gees, disco.
The Carters roll into town. Everything's crazy. Studio 54.
And then
White House Chief of Staff is rumored to be doing lines in the Studio 54. That happened. And he denies it.
You should note that. Okay. Very good.
Yeah. The late great Ham Jordan. But I'm just saying, like, it's kind of a wild time.
So I guess putting this all to bed, what advice would you give to somebody if they, like me, saying, I don't know if I have time for that. I mean, honestly, you have given me an idea for a book. It would require...
Your stories. They're your stories. I'm just saying, put them in a book.
No, I
They're
know that.
They're your stories.
I've already done a book, Jake, and it was a book about the launch of NFL Network, and it took so much out of me. And so, like, what you're doing right now, like coming on this pod, and, you know, I understand, you know, we're friends or whatever, but you just finished, you know, 2 hours of your show. And now you're sitting in your office for the moment. And
in my what?
In your office. You know, it's air quotes. But you're
what would you do if somebody came in right now and just picked up a giant thing of toilet paper and just would it surprise you?
No, it would not. It would not.
So two things. Three things. I'm gonna answer your question. First of all, people should know the book that I tried to, that you and I talked about.
Yes.
You tell these great stories about athletes, uplifting stories, amazing stories, amazing uplifting stories. And I just said, just like get 12 of them, put them in a book, bang.
Right. The amount of research that is required and for me to find the time to do all of that,
I understand. You can hire a researcher, by the way. I mean, that is allowed. Anyway, moving on from that.
Yes.
Okay. Two, my advice in terms of time allocation and making yourself right is you have to commit to yourself the same way you commit when you lose weight. Or when you go on a diet or when you get fit or whatever, you commit. I'm going to 5 days a week, I'm going to hit the Peloton or whatever. 5 days a week, I'm going to run. And you have to make that promise to yourself. And my promise is when I write, and I'm not writing right now, but when I'm in a writing zone, I'm going to write every day for 15 minutes. That's it, for 15 minutes. Because everybody can find 15 minutes in their schedule. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, right before you go to bed, whatever. You can find 15 minutes. If you commute, you know, on the subway or whatever, you just bring your laptop with you, 15 minutes. So that's doable. And if that's all you do, at the end of the week, that's an hour, 45 minutes. That's four pages. That's not nothing. That's good. So that's how I do it. And then the third thing is, I would say, I outline a book before I write it. And I think that really helps in terms of getting me, because it's like, okay, what am I writing now? Oh, I have to write this chapter where these five things happen. That really helps me. Now, some people write differently. Some people are George R.R. Martin from Game of Thrones. He has this thing called you're either a gardener or an architect. Gardeners just kind of go out and plant and see what happens. And I'm definitely an architect. I have the plans. For me, that's very helpful because I have this outline and I just follow it. And then another writing tip that I read from somebody, a legendary writer for The Simpsons, he did a Q&A in The New Yorker that was fantastic. And his whole thing is get the script done first, even if it's crap. And then you can go and rewrite it and make it good. But the main thing is to have the structure. So those are the tips that have always worked for me.
Damn, man. But I think it's sound advice just in anything. It just doesn't have to be writing, that if you give 10, 15 minutes of your day to something else, whether even if it's charitable work, whether it's something else that can actually enlighten your life or enrich it in a way that makes you feel like you're doing something, that's some sound advice. And I do have, like, this is a legit question. And I think I may have asked you this, like, on the back of a bus heading to, you know, the big slick celebrity.
Once again, the big slick.
That's where we had this conversation about the book. I'll ask you this.
It shouldn't be virtual, and you and I should. I mean, that's not for me.
No,
to
I know.
Judge.
We insurance. Knock on wood. We'll.
I really
we'll
look
be there
forward
soon.
To seeing you next year.
Exactly. So last thing for you is how, you know, because I deal with this a lot, and I'm sure a lot of people deal with it in their jobs as well. Where they do hear bullshit. They hear it. They know it. They could smell it. It's coming their way. I get spun all the time on my show. I know somebody, you know, it's not life or death. It is sports, although it's very serious for a lot of people.
People get killed in sports.
How do you deal with that when you know in politics you're being spun? Doesn't matter what side of the aisle it is. And then you go home. Sometimes I'll text you after a Sunday because I'm on the air on a Sunday morning on my football Sundays, and my Twitter feed is filled with what goes on in the Sunday morning shows. And I do see your back and forths in my Twitter feed. And I think to myself, my God, you know, how when you go home, do you sit? Do you decompress? What do you do? How do you deal with that after you deal with that high wire act on live television, Jake?
Well, I think it's probably very similar to you, which is I have a very supportive wife and two children, and they don't really care about what work hardship I might have just endured. Because as you note, it's not like I'm going through the pain. It's I'm having an interview or I'm trying to get somebody to admit something or whatever, but it's not. It can be frustrating, and certainly the last few years have been very frustrating because of all the lying. But beyond that, I go home and my kids are completely in kid land. And my wife is in their world, and also, you know, what she does and dealing with her family members or whatever. And so it the perspective is always there. The perspective of that's great that you're on TV, but you know, we have a Spanish test to study for, you know, that's important. And that's really helpful because it's much more important in the minds of these people who I love so much. And so, and TV, as you know, the other thing about TV is it's ephemeral and we all get to try again tomorrow. Like, so if I have a bad day or I mess up or whatever, or I do something not as well as I wish I had, or an interview doesn't go the way I wanted it to have, I get to try again tomorrow. So none of that stuff really matters all that much. It's my, what I cover matters, but my role in it doesn't.
Right. And then I get upset when I see what people say about the way you handle your business. And I know you, and I'll say this, I know you, you are literally the straightest shooter I know. And you are somebody, I texted you on occasion during some of the most important stories of our lifetimes that you covered, and you were there, and the way you handled it. And I know that it just pisses me off when people think that you have an agenda, and you are like the most agendaless person that I know, Jake. And just even me Instagramming out, reading your book, you know, the responses I get, it pisses me off. And, yeah. You know, I just wanted to say that for anybody that's out here right now watching or listening, honestly, I know you, and there's so many people in this world, certainly in the world of sports, where, you know, you think you know somebody and you really don't. I really do. You're like one of the few people where I could swear that you are who you are, and I know you're not somebody who I don't think you are. And I just kind of wanted to say that, you know.
Well, you're very kind, and I am who I am, for better and for worse. And yeah, I mean, it bums me out too, but by the same token, I mean, I know a lot of people have had their brains broke in the last few years just by lying or the reactions to the lying. I mean, there was a great New York Times story by Ben Smith about this crazy conspiracy theory that this poor guy
on Jeopardy,
who had won 3 episodes in a row of Jeopardy, was doing like some sort of white supremacist sign, and he was not. And I mean, it just shows you that it's not, there is so much disinformation and misinformation and mistrust in this society where you and I are of the Hebraic tradition.
Yes, we are.
And there's Michael Medved, the conservative radio host, taught me one of the last times I did a show, he taught me this great concept in Judaism, which is Dan Lakav Zichud. Or like in Yiddish, it would be your Bobby would say Dan Lachav Zechus or something like that. But in any case, the point is giving people the benefit of the doubt. That's the whole notion. Giving somebody the benefit of the doubt. Does this person, should we really just assume that he's putting up a white supremacist sign on Jeopardy? Should we really run there? And like so much of social media and today's politics, it's like people just assuming the worst. About every, now look, sometimes people prove themselves over time to not be worth the benefit of the doubt, and that's okay. But I just feel like there's so little in our world where people can give each other the benefit of the doubt. So the stuff that you talk about, and it's from I assume in your replies, it's from Trump supporters these days, but like during the Obama years, a lot of times it would be from Obama supporters would be attacking me. I would be lying if I said it didn't, you know, on occasion get me down. Because I think I try to be a good person. I'm not saying I always succeed, but I try, I aspire, and I really do try to see the other side of arguments than from what the narrative is or whatever. Like I don't automatically assume that this person is lying or this person's telling the truth or whatever. I come to it just trying to find out what the facts are because I want my viewers to know what the facts are. And sometimes I succeed, sometimes I fail, but I'm always trying. So it does bum me out, yeah.
Well, I am there for you. And as you know, a whole legion of people are there for you, certainly when we're supporting what you're doing. And this book that I'm holding up again for the podcast audience, The Devil May Dance, go get it. We're all books are sold, acquired online in a bookstore. You are the best, Jake Tapper. Thank you for doing this podcast. I really appreciate
it. Rich, I love you. I'll talk to you soon, my friend.
You bet. And we actually got through a conversation without the whole Die Hard thing being brought up. So
I guess in a way,
just to wrap this up, you're somebody who says it's a Christmas movie. I say it is not. I just, on my own Instagram the other night, there was a big Jenga tower that we put together with my kids, and I just took a shot of it, you know, in somewhat disarray, and I said, it did look like a tower, and I just basically said, welcome to the party, pal, hashtag Nakatomi Jenga, and only one person responded with an emoji, and that would be you, Jake Tapper, a Christmas tree, so... Technically, you were the last one who could not leave it alone. Oh, I saw it.
I didn't know that you saw my emoji.
No, I did. I actually hearted it, but that's okay. That's the way we communicate in this 21st century sometimes. So you were the last one to not be able to leave it alone. And I guess now tag your it. Next time you have me on anything or whatever, we'll do that. You take care, Jake.
I'll talk to you soon.
Clearly, I've known Jake for some time, and I'm so glad that many of you might, for the first time, have gotten a chance to meet the man that you see on CNN, or you have a certain sense of what his takes in the world are, or what his opinions are on the screen. And honestly, I wanted to bring that up. And what drives me crazy these days is me bringing something like that up could be viewed as offensive to somebody. He is literally the least offensive guy I know. He's a religious man, a man of many talents. He is a dad. He is a husband. What you just heard, the most important role for him. And I just wanted to bring that up. And, you know, it's just interesting how you meet people just on an off chance setting, and you never know what sort of lifelong relationship or friendship that you may have. And he has brought up a book idea to me. He mentioned it here, what he thought or thinks is going to be a best-selling book. And I'll be honest with you, I just sometimes sit here and think to myself, I don't have time to do anything outside of what I'm attempting to do every single day, in a day where things can go so fast and things in this world go so out of control. This podcast is about gaining control of your life and gaining control of what you can control, or understanding that what you can't control should not make you feel like you've lost control, that everything that you want to do with your life is inside you. It is inside of you of what you want. And Jake is an inspiration in the fact that I can't imagine his day being crazier, busier, more filled with plans that you have to scrap because his day is so based on current events, and current events change every minute these days. I can't imagine that he takes the time to actually write a book, research it, and write a book. And it's so terrific, and it's so well received. So I guess, you know, maybe I should put my nose to the grindstone a little more, or all of us should be out there thinking, hey, just when you think you have enough, you don't have enough time in the day, maybe you've got a little bit more time. And making sure that when your day is over, taking the extra 10, 15, 30 minutes out can change your outlook, can change what you can do for yourself, if you can do something for others with that time. The phone calls that I made and time that I made in March and April to make sure that I was able to run for St. Jude was a significant amount of time. And it takes a lot out of you, but maybe, just maybe, all of us should take stock and find out if there is something extra that we can do for ourselves, for our mental state, for others in our lives. It's just something to think of, that there's always time in the day for something that you think is important for your self-improvement or that for others. Just wanted to mention that. That's it for this episode of Just Getting Started. I want to thank Jake Tapper. Again, The Devil May Dance, where all books are sold. Go check it out. You will not be sorry. That's it for this episode. We'll see you next Wednesday on Just Getting Started.